Good evening, everybody. Let's start with our practice, as we usually do. So, spend a minute or two just watching your breath, letting the mind settle down. And in the space in front of you, visualize the Buddha surrounded by all the lineage masters, the other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and other holy beings, and yourself surrounded by all the sentient beings. All the holy beings are made of light, and they're all looking at you with pleasure because you're doing something virtuous. So thinking that we're leading all the sentient beings seated around us, as far as the eye can see, that we're leading them all in taking refuge and generating the four immeasurable thoughts and so on. Then we'll say the verses. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and present clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my destructive actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until cyclic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the great awakening. This ground anointed with perfume, flower-strewn Mount Meru, for land, sun, and moon, imagined as a Buddha land and offered to space. suitable for subduing sentient beings.
Idam
Guru Ratna Mandala Kamriyatayami.
Okay. So then imagine that a duplicate of the Buddha comes and sits on top of your crown and on top of the crowns of all the sentient beings around us, facing the same way as us. And they're helping us petition the merit field so we can receive their inspiration.
Glorious and precious Guru, sit upon the lotus and moon seat on my crown, guiding me with your great kindness, bestow upon me the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. The eyes through whom the vast scriptures are seen, supreme doors for the fortunate who cross over to spiritual freedom, illuminators whose wise means vibrate with compassion, to the entire line of spiritual mentors I make requests.
Then as we recite the mantra, light comes from all the Buddhas on all the heads of us and all the sentient beings around us, and that light and nectar flows into us, purifying all negativities and bringing the understanding of the Buddha's teachings into our mind. Taya ta mani mani maha muniya soha taya ta. Please inspire us so that in our minds, in my mind, and in the mind of all sentient beings, may arise a superior realization of equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger towards all sentient beings. A realization of the recognition of them as our mothers, the recollection of their kindness, their wish to repay it, love, compassion, the great resolve, and bodhicitta. And then think, in response to your requesting the Guru Buddha, five colored light and nectar stream down from all the parts of his body into you through the crown of your head. The same thing is happening with all the sentient beings. And the five colored light and nectar absorbs into your mind and body and into those of all sentient beings, purifying all negativities and obscurations accumulated since beginningless time. And especially purifying all illnesses, interferences, negativities, and obscurations that interfere with the cultivation of equanimity that is free of bias, attachment, and anger, and all the other bodhicitta meditations. Your body becomes translucent, the nature of light. All your good qualities, lifespan, merit, and so forth, expand and increase. And think in a particular that a superior realization of equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger, and the other bodhicitta meditations have arisen in your mind stream and in the mind stream of others. Last time we finished talking about the practices in common with the middle scope of being, somebody who wants to attain liberation from samsara. So we finished that, the actual meditation session, and then it says the way to conclude is as before, so dedicating the merits. And then between meditation sessions, as before, you should read about the vows of personal liberation. So those are the pratimoksha precepts. And we went over those before, the eight kinds of pratimoksha precepts, including monastic precepts and the five lay precepts. Okay, you see, think that this has arisen. You read about it and you study about it. And then the text says, this concludes the explanation of training the mind and the stages of the path shared with intermediate beings. Okay, so now we're shifting into a new category. That's training the mind on the stages of the path of great beings. Okay, so this talks about how to develop bodhicitta, and then having developed bodhicitta, how to train in the bodhisattva practice, in other words, the six far-reaching practices. Okay, and so then we come down and, you know, it has the different outlines. Developing bodhicitta, how to maintain the bodhicitta through ritual, and then how to train your mind according to the seven-point instruction of cause and effect, and how to train your mind in equalizing, exchanging self and others. So there's two methods to generating bodhicitta. One is the seven-point instruction of cause and effect, and the other is equalizing and exchanging self for others. So there's a reason that all these meditations come in this order. We may wonder, well, you know, developing all these positive feelings towards sentient beings, why don't we do that at the beginning of the path? Okay, yeah. Why do we have to go through the initial level practice? Talks about death, karma, and that stuff. And the middle level practice, suffering and afflictions, you know, until we get to this stuff, this good stuff, you know, love, compassion, light, love, and bliss, okay. So why don't we do that at the beginning? Because the bodhicitta is the aspiration to become fully awakened for the benefit of all sentient beings. Yeah. So in order to generate that aspiration, we need to see the kindness of other sentient beings, and we need to understand their dukkha, their unsatisfactory conditions in samsara. To understand their unsatisfactory conditions in samsara and want them to be free of it, we first have to understand our own unsatisfactory conditions in samsara and want ourselves to be free of them. Okay. Sometimes we would rather jump over that part, you know, and like, let's have compassion for all these suffering sentient beings. It wrenches my heart. I have so much compassion for them. But we don't want to look at what's going on inside of our own mind and the evolution of our own mess. Okay? But if we're really going to understand the situation of other sentient beings and develop a strong compassion, we have to be able to understand the evolution of our own internal workings. Okay? So that means understanding the four truths for the Aryas in terms of ourselves. Okay? And if we're going to do that and develop the generation, the wish to free ourselves from cyclic existence, first of all, before we can even want to be free of cyclic existence, we have to wish that we have a good rebirth. Yeah, because like I was explaining at lunchtime today, we need a series of good rebirths. Yeah, and so to develop that that motivation to want a series of good rebirths and to create the causes for them, then we need to do the practice in common with the initial level being precious human life, impermanence and death, refuge, karma. Okay? Yeah? So there's a very definite reason that the Lam Rim meditations are put in the order they're in. Okay? And so it's very helpful to understand it and to see that how important it is for us to, we have to really intensely understand our own samsara and want to be free of it before we're ever going to want other people to be free of it. Why? Because we cherish ourselves more than other people. Yeah? So, you know, first of all, we have to do it for ourselves. Then we can want it for others. And then we can also start overcoming this self-centered mind that sees ourselves as more important than others. Okay? So that's the reason for the order. Okay, so there's these two ways to develop bodhicitta, that aspiration to become awakened for the welfare of all beings. Yeah? And both of them are preceded by equanimity. Okay, so equanimity precedes both of these different ways of generating bodhicitta. And equanimity is quite important. We don't have a whole lot of it now. Yeah, not towards sentient beings, and certainly not toward the situations in our life, you know? Because we go up and down like emotional roller coasters, don't we? Yeah? I mean, we're flying high, and then we crash, and then we're good again, and then we're sobbing, and then we feel great, and we're happy and smiling at everybody, and then we're depressed. I mean, Lama Yeshe told us we were like yo-yos, and he was right. Okay? Aren't we? Aren't you a yo-yo? Yeah? The weather is the same, isn't it? The schedule's the same. Our mind, day by day, is like so different, isn't it? And the thing is, we believe every day that the way we see things is true and that that's really how they exist. We really believe that one day the world is wonderful and the next day the world is awful. You know, whatever appears to us, we're such suckers. Yeah? We just believe it. Even though, you know, I mean, of course, everything is impermanent, changing moment by moment, but basically, the days when you're in retreat, you begin after a while, you can't tell one from the next, because you get up and do the exact same thing. The weather is pretty much the same. The people you're with are the same. Yeah. Only emotionally, it's like, you know, it's like riding the Matterhorn in Disneyland. Yeah? Okay? So this meditation on equanimity is designed to kind of level us out, you know, make us a little bit more calm and peaceful and receptive. And it's also good for other sentient beings. I don't know about you, but there's some people, when I know I'm going to see them, I have no idea who I'm going to meet. because their moods change so radically from day to day. I don't know what mood they're going to be in when I see them. You know? So I kind of have to prepare myself for anything, you know? And then I have like one, I have one friend, or maybe two friends, that, you know, when I meet them, I kind of know that, you know, who the person is, you know, because they've done a lot of meditation and they're much more steady emotionally. Yeah. But some people, do you have that too? You don't know from one moment to the next, you know. Are they going to smile at you? Are they going to bark at you? Oh, are we all looking at you? Are we all looking at you? No? Or maybe we're looking at you. Or you, or you, or you. Yeah?
I'm always the same.
She said she's always the same. Karuna, our kitty, you know, one minute you pet her and she's purring, the next minute she bites you. Yeah. And like Mudita, one minute she's calm, the next minute she's like all over the place. Yeah? Yeah, my tree's pretty constant. Yeah. Just sleep. Okay. So, yeah, we're really going to have to introduce everybody to our kitties. They hear about them, but they don't get to see them. Anyway, back to the teaching. So equanimity is something very, very important, okay? So I'll go through how they have it in the text to develop it, and then I'll kind of do another way too. Okay, so here we're doing, you know, the outline, how to train your mind according to the 7 points of cause and effect. And here they're saying, having first developed equanimity towards all sentient beings, then meditate on the recognition of them as your mother. Okay? Yeah, and so then, you know, what to do in the meditation session, what to do in between session, what to do between sessions. And then the preliminaries are the same. And then the reflection was what I read right before we started. Okay. And so that was the request to get you ready. So now we're at the actual meditation session. Okay, so it says, while meditating with the Guru Buddha on your head, clearly visualize before you a neutral sentient being, one who has neither helped you nor harmed you. Okay? So think of somebody who hasn't helped you, who hasn't harmed you, who you feel kind of neutral about. Okay? And so think, this person wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. So really think about that. They're a sentient being with feelings. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. Then think, may I develop equanimity towards this person, free of bias, attachment, and anger. So what would that feel like to have equanimity free of bias, attachment, and anger? Without at times feeling close to them and helping them, and without at other times feeling distant and harming them. So So imagine what that would feel like. And this isn't an equanimity of not caring about the other person, because you have neutral feelings. Because you started out remembering they want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. So already there's some feeling of knowing that person or empathizing with that person. But what would it feel like as you're knowing and empathizing with them? To just feel equal towards them, not wanting to be help them and being attached to them, not wanting to harm them and push them away. And then think, Guru Buddha, please inspire me to be able to do so. And then as before, you know, the light comes from the Guru Buddha into you, purifying, bringing the realizations and so on. Okay, so once you've leveled your feelings for this person, imagine clearly before you someone you find very appealing. Someone you're really attracted to, even attached to. So there's some partiality here. So think of a specific person. And then think, it is out of attachment that I lack equanimity for this person. So really be honest with yourself. It's out of attachment that I have no equanimity here. And then think, in the past, it was due to attachment for attractive things that I was born in samsara. So there's this beautiful person. I'm very attracted to them. I want to be with them. I'm attached to them. And then I remember that it's due to attachment, that to attractive things, that I've been born in samsara again and again and again. And what does that do? How does that impact you? Once you've leveled your feelings for that person, visualize clearly before you someone you find very unappealing. Okay? Somebody who is threatening, who is ugly, who is fearful, who, you know, you find completely disgusting. And try and develop equanimity towards that person. But first visualize them. Think of a specific individual. And then think, my lack of equanimity for this person comes from my considering him to be utterly inimical, which then makes me angry with him. If I do not level my feelings, I will never be able to generate bodhicitta. You can also think that due to the animosity I feel towards this person, that's also made me cycle in samsara and kept me from generating bodhicitta. So how does that affect your feeling of adversity towards that person? Then once you've leveled your feelings towards that person, visualize before you someone very appealing, like your mother, and someone very appealing, like an enemy. Okay, so get those two people. And then think, from their side, they are equal in their desire for happiness and their wish to avoid suffering. My side, since beginningless time in samsara, the one that I now hold dear has been my worst enemy countless times. And since beginningless time in samsara, the one I now consider an enemy has also cared for me lovingly innumerable times. So to whom should I be attached, and with whom should I be angry? may I develop equanimity towards them, free of bias, attachment, and anger. Guru Buddha, please inspire me to be able to do so. And then do the visualization with the light and nectar coming. And once you've leveled your feelings towards them, then think about all sentient beings, whatever realm they're in, whatever they're experiencing. And think all sentient beings from their side are equal in their desire for happiness and their wish to avoid dukkha. From my side, since all sentient beings are my friends, may I avoid splitting them into two groups, holding some dear and helping them, and feeling distant from others and harming them. Instead, may I develop equanimity free of bias, attachment, and anger towards all of them. Guru Buddha, please inspire me to be able to do so. Do the visualization with the light and nectar coming and feel like you've been able to generate equanimity towards all these sentient beings. that's how the meditation goes in this text. Okay, what was your experience? Did you get any sense of equanimity, or where did you get stuck? So really thinking like, well, I'm in samsara because of this attachment and because of this anger and hatred. That's really rather shocking, isn't it? Because usually we think, oh yeah, samsara is due to ignorance, anger, and attachment. And I'm attached to that person, but somehow that attachment to that person isn't going to make me cycle in samsara. Or the anger towards the other person isn't going to make me cycle in samsara. But the way it's put here, it's like, oh, it is. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I find that it's very helpful for me not to have, it's when I don't put my own stuff in between. When I'm able to like take all out, my stories and everything, and that person like becomes totally...
Yeah. So what you're finding is that it's your stories that get in the way of feeling equanimity.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it's not who that person is or what they've done, but it's your stories.
My perception of what they have done and everything.
Yeah.
If I take that away?
Yeah. Yeah.
I
was thinking about that too, that, you know, I see them in a certain situation and ascribe a certain kind of personality to them. And then I'm sure that that's them, and I'm sure that's the only way to relate to them. And that really gets in the way of seeing them as just another sentient being who wants to be happy. So you're saying you got to take all your junk out of the whole thing.
See, oh, she acted like that. That has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
It's all me, poor me. She hurt me, she did that, he did that.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So specifically, you're seeing how the self-centeredness creates the stories, how you interpret everything in terms of me. They help me, they harm me, they like me, they didn't like me. And how that gets in the way of really seeing the other people just as sentient beings. And feeling connected to them, because the mind's so busy, you know, how do they relate to me, and do they like me, do they harm me, blah, 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 they shouldn't be like that, they should be like this. And it all comes from us.
I can share a good story.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess I don't have a choice.
Okay. Yesterday, when I showed my card, I wrote a little note that my card arrived and everything, and had no response of anybody. And my mind went, well, when did Pochampa got her card? Everybody was jumping and everything. So I was like, nobody likes me. And then the way you act is, you know, so. Usually I don't share those kind of things, like, and I said, I'm going to do like, well, jump up, I'm just going to say it, that hurt me. So anyway, so all of that came through.
Okay. So you want me to repeat it for the people?
Sure.
Okay. So yesterday, she showed us her green card at lunchtime. She just got her green card. And... she had written on the board, our little note board, a few days ago, I got my green card, you know, and nobody said anything to her. Yeah. And the fact that we're in silence doesn't matter.
Okay. And I thought it was going to be on the email. Oh, shit.
She was thinking, well, when Venerable Jamba got her green card, everybody was jumping and... was clapping and was so happy, and I got my green card and nobody said anything. And that's because they don't like me. They don't like me and they don't do this and that and that. And so then you spent a whole meditation session or two or three or four writing an email to us?
No, last night.
Oh, okay, sorry. Just after the meditation session, she spent, you know, a few hours designing an email ready to send us about how upset she was because nobody cares. Okay, so so that's what we do, don't we? You know, we interpret everything in terms of ourself. Yeah. Yeah. Then you get jealous of other people.
I have a choice.
So. Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, you can see how the mind just makes up things and then elaborates on it and makes enemies out of everybody. Yeah. I mean, even the cats didn't congratulate you for getting your green card. They should have all purred at the same time.
And bring me food.
Okay. Yeah.
Trying to envision someone I've seen, mm-hmm. and then my mind already makes some kind of evaluation, and it's not real strong. I can get over that, but it's there.
Yeah. So finding a neutral person at the beginning is very hard, because as soon as we meet somebody, mm-hmm. our mind starts making opinions and judgments and evaluations about them, and makes them into a friend or makes them into an enemy, often before we've even said hello. Yeah? And so it's interesting how sometimes very difficult just to find a neutral person to try and develop equanimity with. Hmm? Yeah, everybody's nodding. Yeah? Uh-huh.
I had surprisingly some resistance when I was thinking about the person that I hold dear has been my worst enemy countless times. Mm. And the one that's been my enemy has been my most loved one. I was like, wait a minute, I couldn't quite, the shift was hard.
Okay, so a few people are nodding at this one, that thinking that the person who is so dear to you now was once your worst enemy, in a different lifetime, and the person who you can't stand now was once your dear one in a previous lifetime, that your mind was going, wait a minute, I don't know about that.
Especially the enemy.
Yeah, especially thinking that the enemy could have once been a dear one. Impossible. That person, bad, thoroughly evil, inherently, eternally, never could they have done anything nice to me at all, and never will they. Yeah. So we put them in the category, and we throw them out the window. Don't we? What we were talking about last week, you know, we give somebody a label, now we know what they are, we know how to relate to them. Throw them away. Yeah? Uh-huh.
I found this meditation really helpful after your discussion on Martin Luther King Day. That and the words that I started coming up with were justice and respect. And mm-hmm. I found that in the labeling of racism and all that, this meditation I think is very helpful in terms of that place of respect and.
Yeah, okay. So you're going back to the talk on Martin Luther King Day when we talked about racism and saying that this meditation is really helpful to help you get over, you know, this person is a bigot, so again, throw that one out the window. Or if you're a bigot, this person is whatever, however they're different, so throw them out the window. Yeah. And, you know, the whole key to all of this is looking beyond the superficial appearance of who somebody is and seeing that basically all of us are the same, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. Yeah? And that all the other stuff is basically fluff. But we don't see the other stuff as fluff. We, you know, attribute a lot of meaning to stuff that doesn't have a lot of meaning from this viewpoint.
Mm-hmm. I thought we were talking the other day when you were talking about suppressed anger and that these are moments in time that we string together. Mm-hmm. And then thinking about the person that I was being as an enemy and say, you know, these are my triggers when I see that person. I get triggered because I'm streaming what that person is saying and doing with this, all this stuff that's happened to totally different people at totally different times in my life. And I'm saying, they are like these other people who harmed me.
Right.
So they're going to harm me. And so that thing about, you know, moments in time that we mentally stream together.
Okay. So this whole thing about interesting how difficult it is to freshly see somebody, because as soon as you see somebody, they're reminding you of someone you knew in the past or something that happened to you in the past. And so instead of seeing this person just for what they are right now, the mind starts going into the past and stringing together the present moment with all these past moments of somebody harmed me and I was unhappy and blah, 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 you know. And therefore, assuming that we know everything about the person who's in front of us right now because of what happened to us regarding somebody else in the past. Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because in our mind, we make logical arguments about this, you know. Somebody reminds us of somebody in the past, or they, you know, and we just say, oh, this person is like this person, therefore they're going to treat me like this. And therefore I need to feel like them, like this, in order to protect myself. And, you know, we make whole logical arguments with a lot of therefores that don't make any sense. Because this person isn't like the other people. Yeah. I think I was telling you this story when I went to Marquette University last year to give a talk. And Marquette's kind of a rich school, you know, a rich private school in the middle of a ghetto. So, okay, that already, boy, you know, I got those kids pegged. And, you know, and I look around, they're mostly white, very few you know, people of color. And so, okay, so I have the whole thing set up, but they're sentient beings and they're students and, you know, I feel good about them and I'm going to go give them a Dharma talk. And so I go in the classroom and then there's this one guy who walks in, you know, kind of tall guy who has this kind of swagger that men who think they're important have, you know. And, you know, dressed in slacks and a button-down shirt, short hair, clean-shaven. And he sits down and he crosses his leg, you know, again, in the way that men do who think that they're important. So you see already, you know, what my mind's doing to this poor guy, you know. It's like, I've seen men who think they're important, who are prejudiced against women and prejudiced against minorities, and they dress like this and they walk like this and they sit like this, and, you know, and here he is in the middle of a rich school in a poor neighborhood with hardly any minority people, and I got this guy pegged. Yeah? I really had him pegged. And he sat that, you know, he just was like this with his arms crossed and his leg like that, you know, as I started teaching, you know, giving the talk. And, you know, you know what I mean. You've seen people like this. And then, you know, and then slowly as I began to talk, you know, it's like he began to listen, and his body posture changed, his language, you know, his body language changed a bit. And, you know, I mean, I was aware I was doing this at the beginning. I was kind of laughing at myself as it was going on. So one part was laughing at myself, and the other part was saying, I know who this guy is. Yeah. You know, after the class ended, he didn't come up or anything, so I never got to talk to him and make a personal connection. But, you know, just to watch the mind set all that up. Yeah.
When our mind set ourselves up to enable certain people in certain way, we somehow behave towards this person, you know, in, okay, I already know you, I'm going to treat you badly because I'm going to protect myself, say. Mm-hmm. Then, so in reaction to our behavior, they really do behave the way that we think they
do. Yes.
I got you right.
Yeah. Right, isn't it? Isn't it? Yeah. So you're saying, you know, when we have our prejudice towards somebody else, then of course, you know, we talk to them in a certain way and look at them in a certain way. And then, because we're not being so friendly and kind, then they act exactly the way that we were, you know, afraid that they would act. And then we kind of said, yeah, I was right again. I know who that guy is. Yeah.
Then whereas, when we already watch our mind knowing that is happening, then yes, I might be thinking that you're such and such a person, but we try our best, okay, maybe we should give that person a chance, give ourselves a chance, then we just not to behave our usual way,
yeah,
trying to be kind a little, then the person can be actually very nice people.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting because when we, you know, notice that we're doing this whole prejudice trip. And then we tell ourselves, hold on, you know, let's just be a little bit nice to this person, give them a chance. And then just with a few small words or gestures towards them, you know, and then they respond and we find that actually they're quite nice. Yeah. So it's interesting. It's, you know, I had the image one time that sometimes, you know how a piano player, you know, there's the piano, and a piano player can bring out beautiful melodies, or they can be like a four-year-old, you know, like we did when we were little and tried to play the piano. And that being with people is similar. With some people, if we let down and free ourselves from all this bias and prejudice and I've got them pegged attitude, then we can play them and they become really nice people. Whereas when we don't let go of our preconceptions, then we address them in a certain way and it's like a kid pounding on the piano keys and it's awful. Yeah? It's true, isn't it? Yeah?
Yeah, not directly to that, but also to the equanimity meditation. Because for me it was more humbling, really realizing, okay, the person I'm attracted to now was my enemy, and then it pulls me back to myself, okay, here's my karma, you know? Mm-hmm. And the opposite, seeing a person I have some difficulties with, is seeing that person in an equanimity light, to see, I started to look, what kind of activities or attributes does this person has now, actually, that is, there must be something, because it opened up something to put the person into equal shape, and then also I could see that person in the attribute of a good quality.
Okay, so you kind of, how she was responding, yeah, like, I don't want to hear about it. You know, that my friend was once an enemy and my enemy was once a friend. But you were saying that when you heard that, you found that it helped open you up. Yeah, to think that the person who's your friend was once your enemy, so no reason to be so attached, and that the person who you don't like so much actually at a different time has been kind to you. And so that kind of gives you the feeling, well, maybe in the future I should give them a break because maybe they'll be kind again. Yeah?
No, actually I was more thinking, okay, it relies on me and my mind.
Okay. Okay, so you're thinking more that it's you and your mind, that if a friend becomes an enemy, oh, this is the result of my karma. So don't blame the other person.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And going back to having someone pegged, it can go the way of having a favorable reaction too.
Mm.
I think I mentioned to you in New York, we met this woman who reminded me so much of someone I was really good friends with. And so just laying all of that on this person,
uh-huh.
I couldn't even see her because I was seeing my friend, which is so totally unfair.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the person vanishes and there's just this overlay. Just
yeah. So you're saying it's not only do we superimpose garbage on people, but we superimpose our attachment as well.
Sure.
You know, because you saw somebody, oh, that person's just like my very good friend. Then you put all that on this person, expecting them to be like that. And again, it impedes you from actually seeing who they are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I find frustrations is a very good for equalizing.
Mm.
Because I remember when at work, you know, I had some colleagues who were very difficult to work with. And I got home, I was so angry. And so I just frustrated, and I just, because I put all my enemies to frustrate with me. After a while, frustration just felt funny and ridiculous. You know, to see your enemy prostrating as well, it's funny because not they are collecting merit and I'm also prostrating with them and I'm no different from them. I gossip as well. I say bad things about them as well. So let's all prostrate together. And
yeah.
Equalize in a way.
Okay, so you found doing frustrations a really good way to get rid of the trips about other people, because you put the people that you didn't like around you, who you had a bad time with, and you're all prostrating together, and then you think, oh, they're just like me. They're not any different. Yeah. And then you're prostrating, and prostrating already is an act of making ourselves a bit humble and saying, you know, I could be wrong here. Yeah. So very helpful. Yeah, I often do that when we chant. I have the whole U.S. Congress chanting with me. You know? And then I add the Iranians and the Saudis. And you know, I have everybody there, you know? Yeah. George on one side. Hillary on the other side. And we're all bowing, you know?
Huh? We talk a lot of bad things to people, but I notice when we change from the neutral person to the person that we think is good, and you said specifically wanting to benefit or, you know, to help that person, after the neutral person, it seemed kind of maybe uneasy, and I can't say that I've ever associated with that with wanting to benefit. I think it was that wanting to specifically, that attachment, and I didn't really see that as attachment, you know, wanting to help my family. I kind of thought that was good in the past, as opposed to attachment.
Okay, so the meditation helps you to see that things that you had thought were good, like wanting to help your family, are actually rooted in attachment. Yeah, and that was kind of shocking for you.
Very shocking.
Yeah, because because society really encourages us to help our family. And in Buddhism, too, it talks about, you know, being a benefit to your parents specifically, not so much to siblings and all, but specifically to parents to repay their kindness. But then also realizing that even though it says that, often why do we benefit our parents? It's out of attachment. Yeah. And yes, that's true. And that kind of attachment keeps us locked in cyclic existence. Yeah, that attachment for family is really strong. You know? I mean, I think I was mentioning that there was one person who, you know, she for years has been planning on coming here and ordaining. And now that it's like 2 months away, all of a sudden, so much attachment to family coming. Yeah? So it's quite interesting to see, you know, our attachment to other human beings and what it does to us, how it makes us make certain decisions. Yeah? And, you know, of course we want to be of benefit to all sentient beings. We don't want to harm our family. Yeah? But cherishing them more than others, yeah, that attachment to them can really interfere with Dharma practice. Yeah? In a quite strong way.
That particular time, the way it's written in this meditation, where you have your mother with the person, and that they equally have the right, or there was something about a right before, it's something, but anyway, equally want happiness was also quite vivid.
Yes.
To kind of, from their side.
Yeah. From their side, yeah, your mother who you cherish so much and this other person who you don't like, from their own side, equally want happiness and don't want suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are exactly the same, aren't they? Yeah. But how much trouble we have seeing them as exactly the same. Because somehow the people that we're attached to, they want happiness more. They deserve happiness more.
Or my job is more to make them happy.
Yeah. Right? Oh, yes. People please her. Yes. My job is more to make them happy. Yes. The other people, my job is to make them miserable. Or just ignore them. Well, that's good enough to make them miserable, isn't it?
Yes.
You started?
Well, I was just going to say that the whole thing about attachment is also is not only does it impede our Dharma practice, but the result of that is only going to bring us misery.
Yeah.
And it's really important to remember that.
Yeah. Okay. So the attachment to different people in our life not only impedes our Dharma practice, but in the end it brings us misery because we have a lot of unrealistic expectations of them, like they're going to live forever and we're never going to be separated from them. Yeah, don't we? The people that we're very attached to? Yeah, do you ever think that they're going to die? Yeah, that thought comes in the mind. Banish it. Yeah, but it's true, they are going to die. Or we're going to die, and we're going to be separated from them. Yeah? And how much we resist that idea. And then, of course, when it happens, it's freak out, isn't it? Yeah. And you can really see how that attachment causes incredible agony in people's lives, you know, holding on to people that they just don't want to be separated from, ever. And yet, in samsara, there's no choice about it. Yeah, death is a given, separation is a given, you know, and it causes so much misery then.
The other thing about attachment too is that we don't live our lives fully in the moment, we don't live our lives fully. Because so much of our mind is so focused on particular people that we're always not quite there, we're not quite involved, engaged, giving 100% to whatever we're doing, because there, part of our mind is off wishing, wanting, needing, hoping. And so life is half-lived, because the energy you need to live your life fully has been parceled out to this other situation.
Yeah, yeah. So you're saying that the only time we really have to live is right now, gets compromised by the attachment. Because the attachment, the body's here, certain people are in front of us, the mind of attachment is halfway around the world with somebody else, longing, planning, wanting, wishing, worrying. And we're not with that person, but our mind is completely on them. Meanwhile, the people we're with, we're totally missing out on because we're not fully present for them. Yeah.
The question online, when we meditate on a neutral sentient being, do we also contemplate that life is impermanent and there is not always a friend or an enemy, and also the karma that has conditioned us, I guess, to see people in this room? I'm not clear about the second part. Also on the karma conditions to it.
Okay, so the question is, when we are meditating on that neutral person, do we also reflect what?
That life is impermanent.
Oh, that life is impermanent and the relationship is going to change and so on. You know, and that relationship is caused by karma and the karma is going to change. Yeah, you can, certainly. Because for sure the relationship with the neutral person is going to change as well. They're not always going to be neutral. And I think the thing about, we always start out with a neutral person because it's easier to have equanimity for somebody where we don't have strong attachment or strong aversion. But also with a neutral person, it's very easy to just be apathetic. Yeah, it's like, here's this person. Because like somebody was pointing out, it's, you know, if we're going to think of a neutral person who we know, can you think of a neutral person who you know very well, who you've spent a long time with? No, you know? Because as soon as we spent a long time, they go in either the friend category or the enemy category. Yeah, or they go back and forth according to the day and what's happening. Okay? Yeah. But it's hard. So, you know, when we think of the neutral person, then it's like got to be a stranger. And even then it was hard to be strictly neutral because our mind starts projecting stuff on them. Yeah. But to then think that neutral person has feelings. Yeah. Not for me, it's not even that, oh, they're going to be a friend, or they have been a friend, or they're going to be an enemy, or they have been an enemy. It's more seeing them as somebody who has feelings. Yeah? Because we're so used to city life where you walk by how many people each day, and your job is just to navigate your way through the crowd to get where you want to go or to get what you want. And so all these other people are just, they're just, you know, things on the obstacle course. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah?
Remember, there's actual human beings driving those cars.
Yeah, right, yeah, that there's actual human beings driving their cars. It's human beings, you know, walking in front of us or alongside of us. Yeah, and how easy it is just to, you know, space out. Yeah, and become apathetic. So, you know, with the neutral person, I think that's the danger of feeling apathetic towards them. And also there's the danger of misunderstanding equanimity and thinking that equanimity means being apathetic. Because we think there's attachment on one extreme, aversion on the other, and what's in the middle? You don't care. Because this way cares positively, that way cares negatively. You add them and then average them, and you don't care, you know? And then that's another way that we have of just giving somebody a label. Oh, they're a stranger. I don't know them. You know, it's too much trouble to think of them as a human being. I don't care. Oh, and thinking, oh, well, that's what equanimity is all about, to develop an I don't care attitude towards everybody. Because as soon as I have a positive feeling, I get attached. So if I'm not supposed to get attached, then I better be apathetic. And as soon as I have a negative feeling, I, you know. So we see how easily we go to the plus and minus side, and then we think, oh, equanimity must mean just scratch them off, you know? Like, I don't care. But that's not what equanimity is at all. Yeah? Equanimity really involves seeing the humanity of another person. Yeah? But also seeing that there's no reason to hold them dear or no reason to hold them at a distance, but, you know, to have compassion and care and concern for them in an equal way, not be apathetic in an equal way.
Well, I think, too, I think I've made some progress on this, but I think, too, just to think about having care and concern. Right there, you're starting to trigger the attachment. Right?
Okay.
That's exhausting. How can I care about all these people? You know, it takes so much out of me, right?
Yeah, okay.
So they can separate that out.
Okay. So you're saying that as soon as you even hear, like, equanimity meaning open-hearted, equal care and concern, your mind goes to attachment. Because how can I have care and concern if I'm not attached? And if I'm not attached, and then if I'm attached, then of course I'm responsible for their emotions. And it's my duty to make them happy. And then I'm exhausted.
She doesn't do that.
Yeah. But it's very easy, isn't it? You know, if I'm going to have care and concern, then clearly there's going to be attachment. And I'm so exhausted from taking care of all these other people I'm attached to. You know, how am I going to add all sentient beings to the list? Yeah. So, you know, that's definitely the wrong way of thinking. You are not responsible for everybody's happiness and misery, except your own. Yeah. Zofa? Oh, okay.
So, for me, unless you want to talk to it, but I was one person. So I was thinking about the idea of being curious about other people, having healthy curiosity, not just to my know what their story is. Like a goal of mine, though I'm not there.
Yeah.
But it's like just looking at the other person and saying, I have curiosity. I don't know this person. Mm-hmm. Even if I spent years with someone, I don't know them.
Mm-hmm.
And having, you know, reminding myself to be curious about them.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the thing of having an open-hearted curiosity, not only towards strangers, in other words, not to peg them, but to have an open curiosity, but also towards people we know well. Because sometimes we know people well, and, you know, they're either in the friend camp or the enemy camp, and then we just, again, we tune them out. Well, I know how they're going to be. Instead of, you know, realizing, hey, we never know who another person is, and having that kind of curiosity and interest in them, which is basic care and concern, isn't it?
I was thinking about what Venerable Chung Yi was saying, care and concern and attachment. Mm-hmm. If you were to go on the street and somebody fell down, and you would have care and concern to help them up, and that one, after that moment, is okay, that's it. You will not be attached to that person, that, this person, will he, this, will that happen, and whatever. You will just, okay, help him up, and that's all, okay, bye. Then, but for people who are somehow, it's really very difficult not to have the attachment part that come in.
Okay. So if you're saying, like, if we're on the street and a stranger falls down, we just automatically go and help them up, and there's no attachment, there's no aversion. We help them, and then that's the end of it. We go their way, and we go our way, and they go their way. Yeah, and there's no attachment involved. But if somebody that we're very attached to falls down, then it's like, oh, what happened to you? Are you okay, you poor one? Let me help you. Oh, this is terrible. Are you sure you aren't hurt? Oh. Yeah? I mean, it's true, isn't it? And why are we like that? Because sometimes I don't know about other people. I mean, maybe other people like that when they fall down to have everybody, like, worry about them and gather around them and everything. I don't like it at all, you know. It's like, just help me up and, like, forget about it, you know, unless I have a broken bone, yeah. But it's interesting how the mind of attachment really makes us act differently.
But we are trained like that. We are trained to, because if not, this is, you don't care?
Yeah.
You don't love us? Or, you know,
yeah,
so
it's, like,
we're,
it's like your green card. You know? If they fall down and we don't make a big deal out of it, they're going to think that we don't care about them. Yeah? Yeah? So if you care about me, your job is to create a scene.
Yeah.
Oh, you poor one. Are you sure your bicycle's broken? All about me, isn't it? Yeah?
I have a lot of trouble sometimes coming up with an enemy. I don't like to think about people's bad qualities. Mm. So a lot of times it's just, I draw a blank.
Okay, I can give you some. Okay, he's saying he doesn't like thinking about people's bad qualities, so it's hard to think of an enemy. Yeah? But you know, the word enemy sometimes makes people think that it's got to be real strong. Just think of somebody you don't feel comfortable with. Somebody you don't feel at ease with, you don't trust. Yeah? Like I said, I can introduce you to a few.
Somebody just doesn't appeal to you.
Huh? Yeah.
I don't want to go have coffee with them, you know.
Yeah. You can think like that. Yeah, somebody, yeah, that you wouldn't want to have a cup of tea with that person.
That's seeking hatred.
No, no. No, no. When it says enemy, it doesn't mean that you're, you know, restrain me, I'm going to wring their neck. It, you know, it doesn't mean that. It's, we're just using enemy as a one-word thing to mean people that, you know, it can start off, we don't feel completely comfortable to them, to, you know, we're irritated or stuff like that. Okay, so there's a lot here.
I'm wondering about meditation, about equanimity of unpleasant or pleasant objects or situations.
Okay, so equanimity regarding pleasant or unpleasant objects and situations. Because definitely we don't have that either, that kind of equanimity, do we? Yeah, I like this food or I don't like this food, or I like this, you know, how the room looks, or I don't like how the room looks. Okay, so how to develop that kind of equanimity. One thing that I find very helpful is, as a monastic, to remember that my practice is to cultivate contentment. Yeah, so when the mind comes up, if I don't like, blah, 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 it's like, oh no, my job is cultivating contentment. And then I usually remember that whatever it is that I have a strong preference for, that I want my way on, after a while, I'm not even gonna think about it. So if after a while I'm not going to think about it, why should I make a big deal about it now? Okay, for example, did you ever notice the ugly color that the doors in the teacher's cabin are painted? Yeah, they're painted a really ugly color. You go in the bedroom you want to offer to your teacher, and the door going outside is this yucky color, kind of reddish brown color, you know? And this guy, you know, painted it that color without even consulting me. And then when I did retreat for 3 days in that room, I was in that room with this door that is just so ugly. And I was all set to, you know, like, we have to repaint this door. And then, you know, I just said, okay, my practice is to cultivate contentment. Yeah. that's my practice. I happen to, you know, I have to cultivate contentment. And then, you know, I don't think I've thought much about that door until tonight. Yeah. But I'm sure those of you meditating in that room now will notice it. Yeah. Anybody else noticed how ugly that door is?
No, I noticed the door, but they're not ugly.
It's an awful color. You like it.
It doesn't matter where the other
one. Oh, he got you to paint it. That's even worse. He made you paint it that ugly color that other people like.
I don't care one way or the other.
It's not that I don't like or I like it. I don't care about it.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, so it's that kind of thing, how our mind can, like, grab onto some small thing. Yeah. I mean, she and I, oh, we can get into stuff like where to put a plant. I don't know how many emails went back and forth until we agreed upon where to put a certain plan, you know? Have her tell you the story. Oh, look, visible. Yes, yeah, she's quiet. And she's red. Can be useful not only for objects but also with people, because sometimes we're with somebody and they're in a bad mood and we want them to be in a good mood, you know, and it's like, okay, I've just got to be content with what this person is right now. Or somebody, you know, they're doing a certain job or a certain task and they didn't do it the way we wanted it done, and say, okay, I just have to cultivate contentment. They did the best they could. And what's interesting about this thing of cultivating contentment with what other people have done is that sometimes you realize that actually they did it better than you had wanted it done. You know, that the criticism you had of it is really quite unfounded in that it was actually done well. Yeah, so it is helpful just to remind ourselves, my job is cultivate contentment and satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. I told you once a story which I explored in Hamburg when I was going in a city park and so on, and I used not to look at people or consider people so much, and but with some more, spaciousness now in my mind, I approach people much more, taking them in, and that is a benefit for myself because I'm getting out of myself. When I'm walking on the street, for example, I would be myself, thinking about myself or thinking about people making judgments, but if I'm opening my heart, then it's all much more alive. I'm much more, when Osanke said that there is much more reality. Mm-hmm. So I'm much more in reality, actually, and other people will rejoice in that, too.
Yeah.
And so, I'm benefiting.
Yeah, so that's a very good point, you know, because you have the experience of, you know, I remember you telling me this, that you used to take a walk in a park in Hamburg and not look at anybody, or if you did, the mind was critical and judging and things like that. So you're never kind of completely happy taking a walk even, because the mind was always full of stuff. And then, you know, when you began to really work on your mind and change some of those judgments and leave them aside, then you found that when you walked in the park, you could look at people, you know, and smile at them, and then, or even you didn't smile at them or whatever, you still had some feeling for them as human beings, and that changed your whole experience, and it also changed how you related to the people in the park. Yeah?
And therefore I can understand how it leads to the approach of bodhicitta, because you have to have developed an open mind.
Yeah, because when we're closed inside of ourselves with our preferences and our judgments and our opinions, it's very difficult to generate bodhicitta, because bodhicitta really requires an open receptivity towards other sentient beings. Not a screen and a filter and a club, you know? Yeah, but just some kind of open receptivity to them. Yeah. Okay, this will be the last.
I just wanted to kind of comment on her. I really noticed when I decided that I was coming here and that I wasn't interested in relationships, anyone that changed the way that I associated with women. I didn't want anything from them anymore. I didn't need anything. I wasn't trying to build anything, so it was much easier to relate. It was much, I could just come and be myself. It changed everything.
Yeah. So when you decided to move here, then, you know, the whole way you related to women totally changed, because you didn't want or need anything from them. And that's also what I found very nice about being celibate, is my relationship with men has changed, because there's no stories. You know, I don't want a story, so I don't create a story. Yeah? And then all the things, of course, you do to make somebody interested in you and blah, 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 you know, you just kind of drop all that. And then it enables you to really relate to somebody much more directly, much more honestly. Okay. So, continue this meditation this week. There's a lot to think about, huh? Okay, so people watching in online, please do the same. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Gurana mandala kam niryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups aborting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west floor.